Hello, everyone. Welcome to this interview we're doing today as part of the Quark project initiative we're developing here with Psychic. And we have here today Cameron V and Casson in conversation, and myself, Ale from Dublab. We're going to be talking about spatial sound. We're going to be talking about Casson's work trajectory, and really just what is his take on the idea of spatial sound, and almost the idea of this illusion of 3D that we create through various formats, in this case with a focus on Quark. Cameron, wonderful to have you here. Casson, wonderful to have you here. Thank you so much for joining today. And Cameron, maybe you can start by correcting me if I'm if I missed any of the points in the introduction, or maybe as the kind of the main person behind this initiative, give a better explanation or introduction of what Quark is.
For sure. So Quark is a plugin that stands for the Quadraphonic Universal. Oh my God. It's a great acronym, the Quadraphonic Universally Accessible Resource Kit. And what it is it's there to allow the distribution and encoding of spatial works through any form. It could be vinyl, it could be radio like we're on, it could be Spotify, it could be anything. And what we were able to do through a grant through the National Endowment for the Arts is do a program called Make Music in Space, which was a national call for quadraphonic work, where we offered it out to the public. And in a few weeks, many people actually submitted to this for a review panel made up of folks like Suzanne Chiani, Laura Escudé, Laraji, Craig Leon, and Time Boy. And so all of these works were reviewed by the panel. And Casson and his project. And Casson, how do you prefer going by your name or by your project name, by the way?
Either is fine. Okay. Casson is my name, and Symbion Project is sort of my main artist moniker.
Yeah. So Symbion Project was the grantee of Make Music in Space. So we got a lot of support from different partners like Ableton, The Cargo Cult, FabFilter, Focusrite, Isotope, Moog, Output, Pioneer DJ, Spitfire, and Transmute, so that Casson, as the grantee, not only got a grant from Dublab via the National Endowment of the Arts grant, but also all of those partners were able to empower his spatial music making to go further. So it was a really fun opportunity to get everyone together, and all of the submissions were stunning. It was, most people had little experience in spatial sound, and this was a challenge not only to create a piece of music in that short period of time, but also to challenge themselves to work in space. So, Casson, first off, congratulations on receiving this grant. It's you did incredible work.
Wow, thank you so much. It was a very enjoyable experience. I'm a lover of surround audio, quadraphonic audio particularly, and all the emerging spatial audio techniques and software and opportunities that are out there. So I appreciate you and Dublab putting this whole thing together. It was really fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I would like to start in asking you, as someone that obviously embraces the medium or embraces the technology, what's your first take on what draws you or what drew you to not only participate in this project, but in general embracing this as a medium, right? And what are the potentials you see as a form of expression, as the role of music in society past the listening experience? Why spatial sound for you?
Yeah, yeah. Wow, epic. That's an epic question.
That's an epic question. Yeah, that's it. That's I can leave the recording on, and you'll talk for the next hour.
Right. Well, I mean, Well, first off, I mean, music in general is such this amazing medium that has the ability to take a listener to a new place, take them out of their daily life, stop time, or turn time into something fluid and ever-changing. And that's just with stereo audio. To bring listeners into a more immersive, what I think is an engaging audio experience, is even just a bigger win. And my path into spatial audio came through actual discrete surround audio. Back in the 2007 and 2008, I got bitten by the bug back then of surround. You know, they were releasing CDs or DVD-As and surround DVDs, and I had picked up a few. Particularly, there was Beck's album Sea Change, which I picked up on a surround DVD, and my car, which was an Acura, had a surround sound system in the car. I didn't even have one in my house, and I would go out into my car and I would listen to this surround DVD of Beck's Sea Change, and it was so transformative for me in showing off what an immersive audio experience could be like. It was just fantastic. And so I had already been doing many bands at that time and releasing albums. And so as a challenge to myself, I wanted to mix the album in surround sound and did a bunch of investigation about, you know, what was available at the time, which was mostly just 5.1. But in particular, I got bitten by quadraphonic, mostly because the subwoofer is really about the LFE channel, and that's about rumble and things for movies. And the center channel is for mostly about dialogue in movies. And most people in their surround sound setups have their center channel turned up because that's where the dialogue is. And so I never trusted the center channel because I didn't know what volume it would be at. And given that you have four speakers set up in essentially four stereo pairs, quadraphonic to me was the perfect musical medium. And clearly that was also many artists' decisions back in the 1960s and 70s. When they embraced quadraphonic technology for vinyl and whatever tape playback could support it back then. So I started mixing albums in quadraphonic, and there was a very small but passionate audience out there of people who would listen to DVD-As, but it was just really exciting to get feedback from them about the music I make. I make electronic music, ostensibly. It's very sort of rich and lush. I use a lot of strings and piano, synthesizer, drum machine, that sort of thing. So I've been, for the last 12 years, I've been mixing music in quadraphonic anyways. And I've moved from, now that people don't really use physical medium, I've moved over into just releasing the quadraphonic as four channel waves, 5.1 FLAX, Dolby AC3, just whatever surround format was out there. And about 6 years ago, I got a job at Microsoft working on the HoloLens team. And a huge initiative for them was embracing binaural HRTF-based spatial audio for that device as a way to have the users of that device feel immersed inside a soundscape as they were staring at amazing-looking holograms. And I ran a team there to basically do all these experiences building out spatial audio, HRTF, binaural, essentially, audio experiences there. And so that's where I got bitten by the bug of moving into headphone-based playback, but still having an immersive audio experience. And it's not the same as quadraphonic or discrete channel surround. It's different, but it is equally as intriguing. And given that the so few people can listen to real four-channel audio, but millions and millions and billions of people have access to headphones, immersive spatial audio is really the path forward. I'm never going to give up on quadraphonic and sort of discrete channel-based audio, but clearly with VR or AR devices and just, you know, everybody has headphones in their ears these days, spatial audio is the way to go. And I had found out about Quark a few years ago. Kamran, when did it originally first get released?
You know, that's a good question, but maybe we had It must have been at least 2 or 3 years ago, yeah, when we did the very, very first version. And it was spawned from the work with Suzanne Ciani. So the challenges that it sounds like you faced in those early days of figuring out how people are going to listen to this was the practice that went through releasing her live quadraphonic record.
Right, and, I see.
You know, really her philosophy spawned rethinking all of this, you know? And being, like you said, headphone compatible. That's Cork has spatial binaural aspects to it, just like the old formats of the 1970s, but also the benefit of being able to break it out to a full space in quadraphonic sound or via a home receiver. So your path is interesting. It's a funny thing. I actually worked on that Beck record you're talking about with Elliot Shiner.
Wow.
Yeah, that was a big moment, and that the ELS system and the Acura TL, I guess, is the car that you had. Yeah,
that's what I had.
That was. I wish more cars would do that. It's a beautiful system.
That mix was amazing. I mean, I own that album on vinyl and digital. I probably owned it on CD, but I still hold that the 5.1 mix of Beck Sea Changes, one of the best mixed albums I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah.
To me, it's interesting, and this is a question for Kasten. I mean, Cameron, also you can answer to this. But music inherently, it's a medium that taps into our emotions, right? And tapping into someone's emotions, and in a way, here I'm playing a bit of devil's advocate, but tapping into your emotions can be done through as little as the crappiest of AM radios and a little speaker, and that's how people heard maybe original Elvis, you know, at the beginning, or early blues or rock and roll. You know, you just need that tiny little frequency just enough to hear a melody that will you know, affect you emotionally. So how do you see the role of high-end audio, binaural, surround, you know, all this technology? And do you see that as a way to enhance that emotion? Do you see that as changing the relationship of music in a sense of, like, it's more about instead of theater for the mind, is theater for the senses kind of idea, right? Which it happens in film a little bit as well. What's your take? What is the role of this? And do you think certain genres of music, therefore, would benefit more from something like spatial audio or quadraphonic audio than other genres? Let's say, for example, electronic music is way more visual, maybe, in a sense.
Interesting. Cameron, do you want to start?
That's you. Do it. I'm excited to hear your point of view.
Well, see, you mentioned a few things in your question there. The first one is sort of audio fidelity, and clearly, right, like the path from the earliest AM radios or phonographs. Even back then, people were captivated and drawn in, even with like the limited frequency response, and it was mono and all of these things that nowadays we would listen to and be like, oh, that doesn't sound, that, you know, that sounds horrible. But, you know, I think what people were drawn into beyond just sort of the novel of the technology is whenever you have an artist who can engage with their audience, you know, through, you know, emotive lyrics or an interesting narrative to tell or amazing musicianship and performance, that's always going to engage people no matter how bad the medium is. I think the sort of the quality of that talent can cut through. But the ability to connect with your listener with an experience that sort of excites their senses, to me, should not be diminished. And so obviously, advancements in fidelity are great. Although admittedly, I think we're reaching a bit of diminishing return. I'm a big advocate of 24-bit, 44K audio. You know, over the decades, there's been the push to 192 and all this stuff. And I'm sort of ambivalent to that. It really, you know, if you're recording like live strings or a real human vocalist or a piano or any instrument that has insane harmonic spectrum and you've got state-of-the-art equipment to record it and actually capture all that stuff, then sure, I think there's room for that. But I think 98% of the recorded music out there is perfectly fine with 24 bits of audio. But the big leap is spatial audio. And like you mentioned, I believe personally that it is particularly beneficial for certain types of music, especially live recorded music, to be able to capture the room that that's being performed in with multiple mic positions and then allow the listener to feel like they're in that space, I think is incredibly important. And with the multiple mic positions, it then allows the listener to move around, to actually be like, well, what is it like to be in the audience where I would normally be? Or what would it like to be on stage with all the musicians surrounding me? And to be able to capture that in a live, you know, in a live venue that has amazing acoustics is perfect for spatial audio, because you already have the real natural room and acoustics and all those elements there. I have found as an electronic musician that doing spatial audio is actually pretty challenging. The whole medium is completely artificial and synthetic, right? All the reverbs you hear are coming from, you know, convolution impulse response based reverbs. And so like my piano is in Notre Dame and my synthesizers are in, you know, some Lexicon plate. And, you know, there's like 16 different kinds of reverbs all playing at once. And the sounds are synthetic and the drums came from a drum machine. And it's been a challenge for me. And some elements of music, and particularly when I did this piece for the contest using Quark, I really wanted to use piano because I have found piano or more acoustic sounding instruments to really translate really well to spatial audio, and that the more sound designy sounds of my mix, where I would in quadraphonic, would translate very well. It was a challenge because getting things to move around and feel grounded in the real world is very, to me, is a big challenge for electronic music. Connor, how do you feel about that? Have you found the same thing of electronic music versus maybe more sort of acoustic or natural music? I don't know what you would want to call it.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's sort of, sometimes there are philosophies that are pitted against each other, but frankly, I think they're very complementary in that there's the idea of being there, right? And that is a lot of what maybe your work at Microsoft and what a lot of the VR and AR companies have out there. And that technology and the techniques and the devices that are being made around that are completely fascinating and very complex. Using things like ambisonics to sort of package those things is excellent. And then the other side, like you're saying, with electronic music or music in general, I think sometimes it's about putting people in an environment that is surreal or unreal or a mood state. And what's I find really compelling, and frankly, what you did with your piece even is that you don't have to be within the realm of reality in that, and it's really better. It's kind of like a good song. It's like it's not talking about something that's necessarily real. It could be a character or an identity or putting someone else, like, you know, I'm a huge Prince fan. He would often write songs as a woman or something, like his point of view, right, in state of mind or even his singing voice. So to me, I see where spatial music and quadraphonic in particular can be fuel for these real environments as a soundtrack or a sort of, you know, kind of like you're putting music on in the background or whatever, but it doesn't necessarily have to be the real environment. And there is a really interesting creative balance, but, you know, to what Ali was saying about like AM mono radio and all that, you know, we all still need to check our mixes in mono because even Sonos speakers are in mono. So, you know, or Amazon Echoes, you'll never get away from it, which is, you know, its own challenge in spatial music production. Just a little extra step that you're never going to get away from.
Yeah, well, there's also this trend that it seems like we're pulling in both ends at the same time when it comes to quality. On one hand, we're shooting for technology is getting really good at making pretty high quality recording equipment very affordable. Even these days, you can buy a microphone for $500 and arguably sounds pretty good, right? The same with like ADDA converters. Technology is getting cheaper and pretty good. At the same time, we are working with a software that creates this great masters and sounding music. You were talking about 24-bit, but you can go even higher. But at the same time, on the other end, people have less and less access to CD. I'm talking CD, which to begin with is not that high quality, 16-bit. People have less and less access to this. And essentially everyone, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's listening to MP3s, right? And not only that, but they're listening to it most of the times through earbuds or computer speakers. So what is this pooling from both ends? You know, are we trying to make up for the loss on the other end? And ultimately, as what are we doing with sound quality and the role of sound in our world?
Well, I mean, fortunately, some of the major companies now are making a stronger effort to up their audio fidelity. I mean, yesterday Apple announced, right, their lossless audio, and you know, Tidal does that, and having that offered for music lovers who really want to get the lossless experience is great. I mean, so that's a good step. But you know, you still have Spotify. You know, if people are on Spotify free, they're essentially hearing really low bitrate MP3s and a lot of audio compression. And so it's not great. I think we're making too slow progress. Like, I was super excited when streaming showed up and MP3s were starting to go away, because I was like, oh, finally, between broadband and streaming, we can now basically just move to at least 16-bit waves, right? And then be at least CD quality. And then it didn't really happen, right? Most of people are, you know, kids are listening to music through YouTube, where most of the bitrate is going to the video and not really going to the audio. And so it's every time I see a moment where we can make a step forward, we don't really make a step forward. But, you know, we're getting there. As more people, you know, it's all to me gated on broadband internet access. And when everybody's on fiber, like, you know, I push around 24-bit WAV files. I sell 24-bit WAV files on Bandcamp, even though Bandcamp doesn't support 24-bit WAV files. So, you know, there are ways around it, and real music lovers will seek out those methods.
Yeah, so one time I read they had a pretty interesting article on, I believe it was on KPCC of all places, and they did a research that every time the public and or the industry had to choose a format, every single time they went for the most convenient one. Only a couple of times the most convenient one happened to also bring more quality to the recordings, but most of the times it happened to be that the most convenient one was also lower quality. And that's pretty interesting to hear. And to me, that goes back to the idea of emotion versus the senses, right? What are people seeking out of music? I mean, you say kids are listening to YouTube these days, you know? It's almost like it's just a matter of the technology catching up. And then as the internet gets faster and there's more data that can be processed, or transmitted, right? It'll catch up eventually by itself, right? That's what you're saying?
I hope.
You hope, exactly, yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting, the pendulum of all of this, with looking back on quadraphonic music. Cassin, I'm actually curious about your experience back then in the mid-2000s of producing music then, because what I found in... working on those DVD audio and SACD releases back then, and the complexity of listening. You were one of the few people that had that car that could actually listen to the work that was being done, and the complexity of the systems needed to produce that back then in the, you know, sort of early 2000s, versus what it is today to do the same sort of level of production is drastically different. And if you think back to when something like quadraphonic sound was introduced, there were very few people that even had home stereos. You know, there was like one person in the neighborhood. The Tascam Porta studio wasn't invented yet, so home recording wasn't really a thing. So recording was complicated. And I think to Ali's point about those intersections of quality and convenience are very tough to find. And, you know, in sort of looking through history in something like quadraphonic, for instance, and the techniques used in the 70s, you start to look at, well, what is that path between that convenience on a production and listening level of using that technology like we're using for this, and how that will lead to more ambitious work when there are more resources available, like if one day you have an Atmos system to record and mix on, and the right now the very few people that have that, but as you mentioned, Apple is kind of creaking open the door more by adding that capability with Apple. So I guess what would be interesting to me is, Kasten, when you were just starting to explore this, what were the challenges that you found? What were the hurdles technically in just being able to achieve the ideas that were in your head?
Yeah, it actually wasn't, I haven't found it to be much different. You know, even back in the mid-2000s, like, you know, when I started in 2005, 2006 was when I first started experimenting with mixing surround audio. I use Digital Performer as my main mixing tool, mostly because it's used by film composers, and it's ideally set up to do different kinds of multi-channel mixing. And so I've always found it to be very convenient. And I did my piece for this Quark Dublab contest in Digital Performer. And so even back then, you know, if you have a fast enough computer, that's good. They had a few surround plugins. I could not afford the Altiverb had a surround reverb. I love Altiverb's reverb, but their surround reverb is ridiculously expensive. So I build all my quadraphonic reverbs just out of two stereo reverbs, one in the front and one in the back. I load up the same preset, so it's both plate, or whatever the room is, but I'll actually change the characteristics. So the one in the rear is still the same plate reverb, but it maybe has a different, you know, frequency response, roll off, decay time. So I was sort of faking my surround plugins, which is nowadays I use real surround plugins. So that's definitely an advantage. Probably the hardest part back then was finding an interface that gave me one volume knob for all my speakers without spending thousands of dollars on a true surround A to D. Because, you know, all those things were built for film studios to mix and surround, and I couldn't afford them. There were, you know, $2,000, $3,000 for these 5.1 mixing interfaces. And so it was a challenge for me to find that. And I don't have that issue now. I use an Apollo, and so that's got all the multi-channel outs, and so that problem is solved. It hasn't been huge. Releasing for DVD was very painful because you had to learn how to use the software to build the menus for the DVD system, which was like a horrible experience. And honestly, I'm sort of glad that all went away, because now I can just release a 4-channel wave or a 5.1 FLAC, and I don't have to, although admittedly, I do often, one of the formats I release in is .mp4. So I release a movie file with a Dolby AC3 mix embedded inside that. But, you know, the problem with Dolby AC3 is that's compressed audio. That's not even lossless audio. So it's not like a 4-channel wave, which I can release in 24-bit. So honestly, it hasn't changed. It hasn't been that different, the experience. I think adding the elements like Quark now has been the huge change, because now I can take my quadraphonic mix, I can push it down into two channels and pass that around through a normal medium like YouTube or Bandcamp or SoundCloud or just direct over the internet. And now I have a way to, you know, disperse and, you know, and promote and distribute essentially psychoacoustic 2-channel music, which I think is pretty interesting sounding, just because for electronic music, like you said, it takes you to a surreal place listening to the Quark mixes in 2 channels with headphones on is really surreal. Like, it takes an already surreal medium of electronic music and then does this like a crazy phasey psychoacoustic thing that I actually particularly like. But also knowing that you can then, you know, push that, you can decode that back into 4-channel is amazing. So, you know, that's probably the biggest difference these days.
Yeah. And when it comes to convenience, when it comes to kind of drawing a line, right? As a composer, you talk about Dolby, you talk about Quark or Quadraphonic, and then earlier in the conversation, you were talking about how everything is leading towards the headphones, right? The just because that's what most people have access to. Is there a place where you draw the line where you say, past four channels is too much, or past 7.2 or 7, whatever combination of stuff? Because I've seen systems one time, Cameron and I went to Greg Penny's studio, and he had the full setup, I believe, right, Cameron?
Oh, yeah, full
Which was
setup. It was, I think it was like how many speaker system or something.
20, exactly.
Yeah, right.
And I understand for films, obviously, that has an application, and you know, there's uses for that. But for you as a musician, where do you think it's enough, right? That it just really won't make a difference after a certain number of speakers or channels.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're talking directly about channel-based audio, honestly, Quadraphonic, from the point of view of having your head at the same height level as your speakers and having four speakers around you, is perfectly fine. Putting two speakers above you is pretty awesome, and that's where Atmos gets into, because then you can do things that feel like actually go over you and around you. And so for film, going into an Atmos theater that has all those speakers, I mean, it's pretty amazing sounding. And they have since moved to object-based audio, which means you can really get away with far less speakers, because the algorithms are essentially, you know, locating a sound anywhere you want using much less speakers. So I think that's actually huge that we're able to go to less speakers, but do as immersive or even more immersive movement of audio and positioning of audio, as long as you maintain the height. I actually have an Atmos soundbar here at my house that has two rear speakers. Of course, the rear speakers are wireless, so it's compressed Bluetooth audio, which is not great because at low sound levels, I can actually hear the speaker cut in and out because the signal is so low that the compression is like turning on and off. Not great. But I will say the soundbar actually has speakers that point up in the ceiling and try to actually basically push some signals out of those speakers and ricochet them off the ceiling. And it's actually pretty convincing. And that's huge, because when you talk about convenience, getting people to put rear speakers in their living room or their listening space is nearly impossible. They have to run two cables to those speakers. And people don't like that. They have to have a stand or mount it on a wall. They never have a good place to put it, so they're putting them up in the ceiling and all these horrible things. So I think the big win will really be through good psychoacoustic soundbars that can like fire audio discreetly at surfaces in your room and make it feel like sound is enveloping you. So from a convenience point of view, I think that's the big win. But personally, as somebody, you know, I will always say that just having real speakers all around you is still the penultimate experience.
Exactly. Now, to me, what I like of the Quadraphonic system, the Quark system, and this is maybe me pushing for something we're part of, obviously, but I like that edge of there's a primitive element about it, but also sophisticated element. There's something reduced to its basics, but it's expansive at the same time. And it feels like it walks a very fine line. And it does have, you know, that 70s, vibe of like, you know, you just put four, you know, you just like, you know, front, left and right, back, left and right, period. But yeah, I know what you mean in that sense. And obviously when talking about music, it's very different than when talking about films, right? When talking about motion pictures. Yeah, the applications are way different. Now, to me, moving beyond active listening or watching a movie, what do you envision? Do you see a relationship between how we experience music or the role of music and or sound in our lives in relationship to these, all these formats, languages, systems, and companies that are developing different ways to experience sound? And I'm asking this because you see that floating in the air. You know, you see it with a company like Oda, right? That that promises, you know, a live experience in your living room, or Sony 360 or Dolby Atmos, or even us with Quark. You know, there's that conversation happening around, and I can't help but to think that there's a relationship between that technology and a need to change our relationship with music and or sound in our private spaces or public spaces.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you asked that. Having made and released music now for 25 years and watching how listening habits change and how people digest music and how it becomes a part of their life, it's actually been sort of a sad progression to music as a background activity and not a foreground primary activity of just sitting down and listening. And I think it's actually detrimental, because I think that music can really help people's lives by helping people de-stress or find an emotion outlet for something they might be going through in their life. It's such a powerful medium. And to me, the way that we've engaged because of the internet and our attention spans have dropped drastically. And so I think that surround audio, but in particular spatial audio, because it's sort of one of the convenient aspects of a more immersive listening audio experience, can be used as a tool to potentially draw listeners back in to actually pay attention to what they're doing, because they're getting to hear music in a manner that they haven't before. And I think that's really exciting. I was particularly very enthusiastic about the resurgence of vinyl, and not because of the hipster aspect of collecting vinyl or whatever, but the act that listening to vinyl actually takes action on the user's part. They have to take this thing out of a package and put it onto a device. There's no fast forward. There's no skipping. I mean, you can do all that manually, right? You can lift the needle up and fast forward, but who does that, right? You put it on and you listen to music for 11 minutes. I mean, getting people to listen to music for more than 1 minute is challenging. And so I love vinyl because it turns the act of listening back into a primary act, where it's something you do. I'm going to sit down and listen to this record uninterrupted for 11 minutes. That's all we ask is 11 minutes or 22 minutes. And so that's why I love vinyl. And so anytime there's an acoustic medium or a technological medium with music that can bring people in and get them to focus on the music just for a few minutes a day is important. And I think that spatial audio is a great way to do that, because you're hearing music, I believe, in a different manner. I think it's exciting. I think it grounds you in the location of the music or a virtual location of the music in a way that CDs, standard stereo does not do. And so anything, to me, that's the big win. I can't say that it's better. A lot of times I will listen to, spatial audio mixes of music, and it's ostensibly worse because they've taken half of the instruments and then they just pan them around your head. And it's like almost disturbing and nauseating. But they do it because it's like the obvious thing to do. And like, but that's not great. I don't want to do that. Like, it shouldn't, it's not a toy, right? This is a way to create a new immersive listening experience. So, but when it's well done, I really think it can transport the listener out of their world for a moment. And I think that's important and should not be lost.
Yes. No, it's, I see your point, and I definitely can identify with it, with the early adoption of the technology, and the first thing you do, you make it spin, right? Kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And you could hear similar attitudes towards stereo at the beginning, when you hear some of the 60s recordings where they would put the voice on one side,
yeah, right, exactly,
and the entire band on the other, and it's almost the novelty, and people are starting to trying to figure it out, right? What yeah, to do. And the first one you do is like, let's make it spin, kind of thing. But that takes me to almost to a place where I want to hear what are your thoughts in looking at where we're at now. How is the technology being used? What's next? What do you envision for this? How do you see the evolution of immersive sound? How do you see the evolution of the use of call it Dolby Atmos or Quark or any other technology, where do you see it going?
Well, I think there are two big areas. The biggest one for me is as mono or small stereo Bluetooth speakers, battery-powered speakers, get cheaper and become higher quality, you will find that you will have a lot more speakers, physical speakers, hanging around in your house. You've got a speaker in your phone. Phone speakers are definitely getting better. They're not great, but they're getting better. All these small, you know, Sonos, Alexa, like what the, you know, all these like home mono or stereo speakers are sitting in your house. And if the Bluetooth spec could change from stereo audio to multi-channel audio, you would be able to send multi-channel audio individually to different Bluetooth speakers. Now, I know there is emerging multi-channel audio capability in Bluetooth, but I believe it currently just sends the same stereo signal to multiple Bluetooth devices, which is not what I want. What I want is I want a four-channel, a quadraphonic encoded wave file to be able to send to four different speakers, with each speaker getting a mono stream or a stereo stream, whatever, that sort of thing. Anyways, when Bluetooth becomes multi-channel and you have all these cool little Bluetooth speakers in your house, setting up an ad hoc surround sound system will not be difficult. And if it's not perfect, right, with your speakers exactly, you know, a meter and a half in front of you, left and right, I mean, if you just put them sort of all around you, the algorithm could actually calibrate all your random Bluetooth speakers and create a pretty decent immersive multi-channel, channel-based audio experience. So I'm excited about that. We'll see if it happens. I don't know. And then when you have audio that is encoded with Quark, you could just load up YouTube or you load up Spotify, and then your system would take that, decode it, and suddenly you have a surround sound immersive audio experience in your living room. That's my hope. My hope is, I'm pinning my hope on multi-channel Bluetooth speakers. The other big win for me is in the world of VR, AR, XR, just that whole world with spatial audio, where people clearly have headphones on because they have a device strapped to their head, and being able to do immersive audio experiences there that are paired with visuals that back up those experiences can be really powerful. And I've been working on a VR project called Morph, which is a spatial audio interactive music experience for ambient music. And it's very powerful. When you couple visuals with the audio, you trick your brain even further into believing those visuals are out there in space around you. As visual beings, we often require our eyes to back up what our ears are hearing. And so I think there's also a huge, you know, there's a huge win in terms of two-channel based spatial audio in the world of VR.
Yeah. Well, I mean, now that you mentioned we're visual beings, do you think we're visual beings more than listening beings?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah.
I just think evolutionarily speaking, you know, we got our ears to make sure that when the sun went down, we could hear the tiger that was about to eat us. But man, like, we are visual people primarily. I mean, I don't know if that's backed up by science. This is my personal feeling, but you know, humans just love visuals. It's why music is being listened to on YouTube. They like the visuals. People yeah. just love visuals. And so look, if I have to capture somebody's attention to listen to my music by pairing it with visuals, and Cameron, you mentioned this earlier, it's why electronic music is often paired with interactive, you know, expressive, reactive visuals, because it takes that music to an interesting new level that, you know, fires off a bunch of all the nice chemicals in our brain when our eyes and ears get something that has good synesthesia and, you know, pairs together.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting too, like what you mentioned about the visual beings, because when you talked about the resurgence of vinyl, for instance, what I've seen with, as you get into spatial sound and, you know, adding visuals to music, once you get into an experience like vinyl, it is engaging your other senses and complementing that visual and auditory experience, whatever that is. And really, because we're all on our yeah, it tastes, you know, you can lick it if you want, you can smell it, you know, and it's just like it sort of, you know, because we're all on our phones all day and it's all visual and audio, yeah, and it just flips it. But it is, our eyes are driving the car, you know, and every time we can add all of these other things, it really starts to excite our brain in a good way. It's really cool.
No, and for what you're saying, Carson, in essence, you see this technology going to the place where it eventually becomes invisible, meaning that it's so advanced, it's so sophisticated, that it's not even there anymore. It's just integrated into our lives, and it just, like, by magic, it just sounds like the sounds of nature if you would be in a field, right? Where no longer you have to configure anything. It really comes from multiple sources, and those sources of sound speak to each other and they balance each other, even capturing where you're standing in the room, right, as you move around your house.
Yeah. I mean, with camera sensors, you could do all sorts of crazy things, right? Because if you can track the movement of the listener's head while they're doing other things and moving around, you can adjust the sound field based on that movement. But, you know, of all that requires people to have, you know, LiDAR and infrared and cameras in their house watching them move around, which I don't know how comfortable. Well, we have them on our phone.
Eventually, they'll put it in our brain, and that's it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Cool. Now, this is thank you so much for sharing all these thoughts. I think it's great to hear what your take is and kind of your philosophy behind embracing the immersive sound, and in this particular case the Quark system. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, as you can hear, I will talk endlessly about it.
Yeah, no, I can go on and on, you know. I'm just trying to format it so we can, like, you know, broadcast it afterwards within not a 6-hour conversation.
It's a good problem. Yeah. Good problem.
Yeah.
Cool. And congratulations, Carson. It really was very impressive work, and frankly, everything was so good. Unexpectedly good, whether it was experienced folks like yourself or people just trying it at the beginning. It was amazing. And you know, we really, you know, made it as blind as possible to the review panel. So they knew all they knew is some basics about your process, your prompt, and just experience level, you know, and that's about it. So it was,
well, that's great to hear.
It really came from very active listening. So congratulations.
Very cool. Well, you know, hopefully, you know, you'll be able to do more of these in the future. And, you know, anytime encouraging people to think beyond just the two speakers or headphones on their head is great.
Yeah.
And let me know if you want me to be a judge. I'd love
to
be a judge.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
I'll be on the other side.
Yeah. I'll pick you up on that.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, Carson. It's wonderful to be talking to you today. Really,
yeah, this was great.
It.
Thanks for including me and letting me chat about this contest in Quark.
Yeah, thank you. For those out there listening, this was a conversation between Carson, Cameron V, and myself, Ale, here as part of a DubLabs project, Quark, that is done in cooperation with Psychic. Is that's correct, right?
You got it.
I got it right.
Your
yes.
Crazy accent works sometimes.
It works once in a while. Can you say the spelling of Psychic?
Oh, C-Y-K-I-K. It is. It's a somewhat of an alias in my other identity, and stemming from years of work with my brothers in the beginning and going into other weird things with you all.
Cool. And yes, this project, also want to remind people, is supported by the National Endowment for the Arts. So thank you so much to them for making this possible. And thank you to all the judges that were part of this panel. I don't know, Cameron, if you want to mention them here, so for the record.
Yeah, absolutely. So Suzanne Chiani was really the beginning of this project in general, Quark. And was very kind to be a panelist with us, as well as Laraji, Time Boy, Laura Escudé, and Craig Leon. All various adventurous beings that donated their time to make this possible. And, you know, we also got a help from another adventurer, Sarah Stevenson, who was crucial in organizing all of this with us at the beginning. So it was a team effort for sure.
Great. Thank you so much, everyone out there. For more on the Quark project, visit Cameron.
Quark.
What's the link?
Quark.psychic.com. And with
great.
The funny spelling of psychic, C-Y-K-I-K.
Yeah, so just Google Quark and you'll find it. It'll be there. Cool. Thank you so much, Cassin, again for joining. Thank you, Cameron. And thanks, everyone out there listening.